My guest is rock critic Greil Marcus, author of the new book, Dead Elvis. Before we talk, here's a short reading from the first essay in the book.
This is the first piece in my book, Dead Elvis, and it's a piece I wrote when I found out that Elvis died. I was in Hawaii on vacation, and Rolling Stone called. I was working for Rolling Stone at the time, and they said, "You gotta write about Elvis." So I did, and this is what I wrote. Like most other people my age, 32, Elvis mattered to me in the 50s. I loved his music, bought some of his records, and never went to any of his movies. He was thrilling, but he was also weird, and I kept my distance. Clearly, though, I had some sort of buried fascination with the man. And when he appeared on TV late in 1968 for his comeback, I found I could handle the fascination. In fact, I was caught up in it, and for the next 5 years, I spent far more time listening to Elvis's music from the beginning on down than to the music of anyone else. I found, or anyway I decided, that Elvis contained more of America, had swallowed whole more of its contradictions and paradoxes, than any other figure I could think of. I found that he was a great original artist, and I found that neither of these propositions was generally understood. So I wrote about it all, feeling, after 20,000 words, that I had only scratched the surface.
Greil, why have you remained so interested in the manifestations of the dead Elvis over the years?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One reason is that I think there is a great mystery in Elvis's music, and that's the mystery of how he managed to come out of nowhere and affect so many people, me included, so deeply. That's part of it. The other part is that after Elvis died, one would have expected him to freeze, to become fixed as a kind of single, sterile image, which is what happens to so many dead leaders, dead pop stars. And that didn't happen. The opposite happened. After Elvis died, all kinds of people began to recreate him in their own way. They recreated him as a horrible, bloated, fat dope addict. They recreated him as a saint. And they began to recreate him as the years went by in ever stranger incarnations. Elvis Hitler, Elvis Nixon, Elvis Christ. And I just was awestruck. And simply as a fan, as someone who was paying casual attention, I just began to clip and save every strange manifestation I came across with no particular purpose, the way someone obsessively collects newspapers when they're oppressed by the news. And after a while, I realized this story wasn't going away. It was just getting bigger and more interesting. And so many of these manifestations of Elvis's presence in our culture seemed meaningless by themselves, but connected to all the others that were swimming around them, I knew there was some kind of story there, and I wanted to try and tell it.
So how many articles do you have by women who were impregnated by Elvis's ghost?
I have a few. I mean, I don't have whole articles in the book about that, but I write about that because there are people who talk about it. Lucy DeBarbin wrote a book called Are You Lonesome Tonight? The Untold Story of Elvis Presley's One True Love and the Child He Never Knew. It was a national bestseller. It was an amazing book. This woman wrote about the love affair that she had had with Elvis beginning long before he became famous and lasting until his death. She became pregnant twice by Elvis, and she had one child. She, of course, never told him about any of this, and she lived her whole life as a silent partner of Elvis Presley. And she wrote the story of her love affair with Elvis in enormous detail, and it is one of the most scary, pathological books I've ever read. I mean, I don't know for a fact what to make of any of this, but as I read the book, I was reading a truly psychotic autobiography of a woman who was not lying, who believed every word she was saying, and who, in a way, had acted out a response to Elvis that millions of people shared. And what I mean by that is that so many people say, of all sorts, that when they heard Elvis, they had the feeling that he was singing right to them. And I think this woman had the same response, except she made it into a life.
You know, they still show a lot of Elvis movies on TV, and the other day I was watching, I think it was Easy Come, Easy Go. It's a 1967 movie. He's with the Navy, and it was really depressing. I kept thinking about how alienated he must have been making this movie. Here it is. It's 1967. There's a consciousness about Vietnam already in the United States. The counterculture has started. Psychedelic music is coming onto the radio. And Elvis is singing the squarest songs imaginable in a movie in which he's in the Navy. And he's so completely out of step with what's happening, like, in the vanguard of American
right.
culture. And you wonder, like, what is going through his mind? He can't even like the music. I mean, this is, like, really the worst of, you know, Hollywood musical square music. Do you often think about how alienated he must have been during parts of his life from what his career was turning into?
Well, he would sometimes throw up before he had to sing those songs.
The movie songs?
Right. I mean, not with everyone. And I'm not saying
probably
that
with
as,
these.
I'm not saying that as a metaphor.
Yeah.
He would sometimes actually throw up. And I think there was a tremendous sense of self-hatred because he knew he had become simply a cog in a factory. But I think he was so imprisoned by the limits that he had accepted. In other words, he acted in the 50s, I believe, as someone who wanted to shock the country, who wanted to threaten the country, who wanted to live in a different world. I think when you watch him in the old films of his 1956 TV appearances, the insouciance and the provocativeness is just obvious. This is not just some naive country boy doing what comes naturally. And I think in a way, he must have gone too far for himself. He must have been scared of how far he'd gone. He must have, well, think of what it meant to live from the time he was 21 years old in a society where everybody knew who he was, and half the people in the society hated him, and half the people worshipped him. Imagine carrying that. So I think he needed to get back. He went so far back that it was almost impossible for him to get out again. And that's why the sense of release in the 68 TV show is so profound and scary and tragic, because that great burst of freedom then turns into the same prison, the Las Vegas prison, very quickly.
And in this TV show, he's just wearing, I think, like jeans and a leather jacket. And he has his musicians behind him just backing him up on, you know, a couple of guitars and a bass. It's real music. It's not the kind of glitter and surface that...
Well, it starts out, he's sitting on stage. This is the first time he's been before an audience in 9 years. And Scotty Moore, his original guitar player, has an electric guitar. DJ Fontana, his original drummer, has drumsticks, but no drums. He's beating on a guitar case. And there are a couple friends around El. Come on, El, do it, El. And he starts out strumming an acoustic guitar, and he's parodying his old songs. He makes fun of them. And then it's as if he's sick of that, and he takes the electric guitar away from Scotty Moore, and he starts to play it. Now, this is the first time anyone had ever seen Elvis Presley play an electric guitar, and also the last. Shocking. He can play. Not only can he play, he can really play. He doesn't play complicated Eric Clapton riffs. He plays like a bluesman in an after-hours club. It's noise and it's rhythm. And then passion takes over, and he begins to sing old songs in a way he never sang them. He begins to sing songs that he made great records of, and he turns those records into ashes. It's staggering. It's astonishing. And you realize how scared he must have been. And then he reaches a point in the concert or the show or whatever it was, he's not scared anymore, and he knows that he can do something he never did before, and he just charges ahead and does it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is rock critic Greil Marcus, and he has a new book called Dead Elvis. That's a collection of pieces, including new pieces, about the manifestations of Elvis since his death. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Greil Marcus is my guest. His new book is called Dead Elvis. I want to get back to your collection of Elvis manifestations in our culture, the Dead Elvis collection. What are some of the recent things that you've clipped or filed?
Well, the most amazing thing that I... There are two things that I found recently that are completely different and yet somehow are the borders of this story to me. One is an Elvis phone sex tape that's circulating on public radio in Australia and has been for a couple of years, although it was made in New Jersey. A performance artist called up a real phone sex worker, and he said, okay, you know, this is what I want to do, and they got into it, and she's urging him on, and suddenly he stops. He says, stop, stop, I'm Elvis. I'm dead. You have to bring me back to life. And she gets very rattled. She doesn't know what she's supposed to do. And he says, you have to bring me alive again. Come on, come on, do it, do it. And so she begins doing her phone sex stuff, trying to bring Elvis back to life, or this, you know, this freak on the other end of the line. But she's very nervous, and at one point he says, okay, I have to hear That's All Right. Sing That's All Right for me. And she knows the song, Elvis's first record, and she starts to sing it in this very tremulous voice. And he says, I'm coming back to life. I'm coming back to life. I'm coming back to life. Come on, keep going. And yeah, she's just having a fit because this is scary. Well, finally, it ends, and the performance artist tries to pull the string. He says, gee, that was really great. Suppose I call you up next week and we'll do it again, and I'll be Barry Manilow. And she says, I don't think so. She says, I'll do Elvis again, but I won't do Barry Manilow. So she throws it back at him. That's one, and it is a harrowing thing to listen to. The other story, the other manifestation, I came across just a couple of days ago, and it's in a story about what was going on in Moscow during the coup. What happened was this. After Boris Yeltsin went out and got on that tank and he gave his speech, he went back into the White House and he called John Major, the Prime Minister of England, and he said to him, I don't know how much time there is left for me. And then he locked the door of his office and he sat down and he put on Are You Lonesome Tonight? He just sat there listening to it.
Now, how'd you hear about this?
This is based on interviews with Yeltsin that were done recently. Now, I love that story.
That's a great story. How often do you go back and listen to your Elvis records?
I guess about every few months, I have a need to hear a song. And I'll say, oh, I just have to hear Any Day Now, which is a ballad he recorded in 1969. And then one song will lead me to another, and 3 hours later, I'm still playing them.
Your Elvis collection, do you have it filed systematically?
In no way. When I started collecting this stuff, and that's even too fancy a word, when I started throwing these things onto a shelf is more like it, that's what I did. I threw things onto a shelf with no particular purpose in mind. And then the shelf became a bookcase. And then it became two bookcases with huge piles of worthless junk and fascinating images. And when it came time to write this book, I simply went through the piles again and pulled out the stuff that seemed the most striking or the most unsettling and just picked. But I don't have anything filed in any way.
When you're in a store and you see some, like, Elvis bourbon or an Elvis salt shaker, do you buy it?
No. No, those are... I got to tell the truth. I went out and looked for an Elvis bourbon bottle. And I looked and I looked. It was hard to find. And I found one. And it cost a lot of money. And I bought it anyway. Because there was something so perverse about it that you twist the head off the bottle and you pour the bourbon out of the neck, that I just couldn't resist. And I still have that bottle. But that's the last thing that I bought. When Love Me Tender Chunks were put on the market, you know, the first Elvis licensed product after he died was Always Elvis, which was advertised as the wine Elvis would have drunk if he drank wine. When Love Me Tender Chunks were put on the market, they were not advertised as the dog food Elvis would have eaten if he'd been a dog, but fans immediately came up with that slogan. And I thought about buying a big 20-pound bag of that stuff and just sticking it in the corner of my attic, but I didn't do it.
You know, a recurring question that gets asked in your book is, did Elvis go to heaven or hell?
Right.
Is this a question that you think a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about?
Yeah, and I think some people think about it very, very seriously, and some people think about it as a tremendous joke, and underneath that joke is great seriousness. My feeling is, and I have a whole gallery of images in this book, 15 or 16 pictures that show Elvis in heaven and Elvis in hell. And as you look at these pictures, you realize, and they're all made by different artists, you realize that hell looks like a lot of fun, and heaven looks really terrible, very oppressive. My feeling is that Elvis gets to commute.
Rock critic Greil Marcus, his new book, Dead Elvis, is published by Doubleday.